This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Elisa Park, who's Associate Professor of History at the University of Iowa, and she'll be talking about her new book, Sovereignty Experiments, Korean Migrants and the Building of Borders in Northeast Asia, 1860 to 1945, which was published in 2019 by Cornell University Press. People moving from one place to another in large and sometimes unanticipated numbers is today one of the most pressing issues which citizens and their governments across the world must deal with. The difficulty of reconciling modern nation states and their supposedly firm borders and sovereignty claims with the inherent mobility of human populations is evident everywhere, from Arizona to the Mediterranean and from Kenya to Myanmar. But if transnational migrants pose such apparent problems for well-established polities, what happens if both people and the entire political order of sovereignty and boundaries are in flux at precisely the same time? Elisa Park's captivating book, Sovereignty Experiments, draws our attention to a time and a place when this was more or less exactly what was going on, namely the meeting point of what we now call China, Russia, and Korea from the mid-19th to the mid-20th centuries. Focusing in particular on Korean migrants and their movements from the Korean Peninsula into Manchuria and eastern Russia, Park shows how this group's entanglements and negotiations with shifting power centers in Beijing, St. Petersburg, Tokyo, and Seoul fed into a total reimagining of what it meant to govern territory and population at this time. Drawing on Russian, Korean, and Chinese sources, Park opens our eyes to both intimate migrant experiences and higher-level government machinations which unfolded at this meeting of worlds during this period, deftly interweaving the personal and the political and showing how they interrelated. While occurring in a less well-known location, often obscured by the large states and empires which surround it, this activity, as Park shows, had much wider ramifications for questions of nation, state, territory, and ethnicity, and how these were understood not just in Korea, China, Russia, and Japan, but more widely. Many of these ideas arguably continued to reverberate through the latter 20th century and are still with us today. But the author herself is here to tell us how all this played out, and so I'll say, Elisa Park, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to appear, and perhaps it would be good to begin by discussing how you came to this pretty fascinating borderland region and how you were became interested in the sort of transnational questions that that book deals with.
Yes, absolutely. So the book originated with my interest in Russian history and its connections with Asia over two decades ago. In college, I stumbled upon a Russian language course, naively thinking that after a few classes, I might be able to read the great Russian novelist. But, you know, from there, my interest in Russia and Soviet Union, particularly as multi-ethnic entities, grew organically. And I had an opportunity to travel to Russia. So my first time there is the mid-90s, and I am in Irkutsk in central Siberia. So for those of you who don't know, that's right on Lake Baikal. And I was struck by the cosmopolitanism and the internationalism of the city, but in a way that I was not familiar with as someone from, you know, Queens, New York, which itself is, of course, very cosmopolitan and international. You know, there were a mix of, you know, Slavic peoples, Chinese, and other Asiatic-looking peoples, but obviously they were all speaking Russian. And one day I was on a trolley bus, and I'm, of course, hearing Russian around me, but then I hear Korean. And I look up, and there is a Korean family, you know, a grandmother, her grandson, you know, her daughter. And I was so curious, and I asked them where they were from, and they said that they were from North Korea. And I was, you know, we sort of looked at each other with mutual curiosity, me being from, me being Korean-American. And, you know, I later learned that there had been trickles of migration from North Korea to the Soviet Union. And then in my studies as an undergraduate, of course, I learned that there had been a much larger number of Koreans who had been living in the Russian Far East, who had then been deported in total by Stalin in 1937, forcibly moved to Central Asia, primarily Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. So that was sort of the beginning point that sparked my interest in this area. Later on, I went to graduate school, and the idea was to actually kind of go backward in time. So the, you know, the beginning point for me was Central Asia, and I had actually, you know, traveled there as an intrepid traveler, college student. So in graduate school, I wanted to go back to their own origins in the Russian Far East and also Korea. But I go to graduate school, and then, you know, I enter for Korean history. And I'm just surprised to learn, again, perhaps naively, that Russia as a subject of study is just not done by East Asian historians. It's like very other. And I mean, it's ironic when we think, I mean, you just have to look at a map. Much of Siberia, Russia, the Russian Far East borders on China. It's just very much a presence in East Asia. It's also surprising that it's not included when we consider, you know, the course of geopolitics of history in the 20th century. Especially post-1945. So I was always guided by this question of why is Russia not included? And then, you know, delving in graduate studies in Russian and Soviet history, you have historians looking at Central Asia, right? And then, you know, Ottoman Empire, those connections. But then why not East Asia? So this kind of question of this like juxtaposition of place, but also connections. I knew that there were people traveling back and forth across the border. I mean, it's just sort of common sense. And so that was another beginning point for me in graduate school into this project.
Right, right. Now, I mean, do you sort of have an answer, I guess, about why Russia is so kind of occluded from this? I mean, not just, I guess, in disciplinary terms in academic activity, but also a kind of broader consciousness. I mean, it sounds like you were quite surprised to bump into these North Koreans on the Irkutsk trolley bus. And I mean, the kind of level of awareness that is there, you know, about a Korean presence within the former Soviet Union. Do you think, is that mostly, do you think, a kind of Cold War vestige to do with just not knowing a great deal about the place, or are there other reasons?
Yeah, I'm actually, as you were, you know, formulating your question, I was actually thinking that it was because of the post-1945 politics that at least we in sort of North American, European, like, oh, probably maybe not Western Europe, but at least North American scholarship has occluded Russia. It's sort of this blind spot in East Asian history. And I would also say that for East Asianists, I think it is the specter of the Japanese Empire and the very large presence of U.S. power post-1945, which has guided what historians of East Asia have then studied before 1945. So now you have, you know, what was the U.S. doing in Japan, Korea, China in the 19th century? What were these other Western European powers doing there? But yeah, these Cold War rivalries, Russia and the Soviet Union are left out in that historiography and also in our consciousness.
Right, right. And yeah, so it's interesting, I guess, there to look at how the present sort of imprints itself on what we can actually naturally see of the past. I guess in a way, the book is a fantastic act of salvage of kind of looking at things from the other end of the telescope and bringing us sort of forward to how we did actually get to the situation we are in from sort of the history of a Korean presence in these different areas. So we'll move into talking about the book. Perhaps now we know something of the really fascinating background to it. So you have kind of set the book up in the introduction, giving us a bit of a picture of the region and this small kind of, well, I guess it's not actually a particularly small area, but it's a real focal point for where these different countries, Russia, China, Korea, in shorthand, all come together, the Tumen Valley. So it's hard to discuss anywhere that's kind of emerging as you're talking about it, a sort of, you know, location in the making. But can you give us a bit of a picture of this Tumen River area, the Tumen River being the sort of border river between China and North Korea these days and between North Korea and Russia, and what was going on here in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Yes. So the Tumen River area is a tripartite border region between Northern Korea, China, and Russia. Russia was a latecomer to the region. It, you know, because of a treaty, it gains a significant amount of land in 1860. And the Tumen River area is sort of surprising, but not surprising in many ways when we look at it in comparison to other kinds of border areas or frontier areas. So in terms of its uniqueness, this area was one of the only land borders in East Asia. It was also unique because it was this land border between two bureaucratic centralized states. So this is China and Korea. So unlike other sort of border areas, which fall off the radar of the capitals of states because of its remoteness, there was actually due attention paid to this area. And in fact, it was governed by a policy called the prohibited zone or the prohibited policy. And so this policy was upheld both by Qing China and Joseon Korea. So what is this policy? Early on in its rule, the Qing decided to segregate this area. So the area, the Tumen River area, was part of Manchuria, which was considered the historic homeland of the Manchus. So the Qing, being Manchu in origin, the Qing decided to segregate this area to preserve the ethnicity, the ways of life of the Manchu people, if you will. And so no one was allowed to live there except the Manchus. People who were already living there, who were various indigenous peoples, the Heje, the Odochin, various Jurchen tribes, and also people who were given permission by the government. And, you know, there was punishment. I mean, whether or not this is actually upheld is a question, if you cross into the zone or not. So the region was also segregated because of its natural resources. So because of the tribute system, the commercial activity in the region was not allowed. So the natural resources in the region You know, wild ginseng, gold, pearls, you name it, it was there. Many of these items were reserved to be offered up to tribute to the Qing Emperor. On the other side of the border, we have Chosun Korea, which similarly upholds this policy. So the punishment for crossing into the zone, that is crossing the border, is execution. You're beheaded and your family is made slaves. So this was for Chosun as a relatively small country next to a very powerful state like the Ming and then the Qing. It was also a security measure. They didn't want trouble from the people living on the other side. So this was the uniqueness of the Tumen River area. On the other hand, it was quite common to other border and frontier areas. So what is the attitude towards a frontier? It's often considered a hinterland, a place of barbarians. And for the Chosun court, it's a place of the barbarians because they consider the indigenous people living there to be so, the Jurchens. And it was also located very distant from what they considered the seat of civilization, which of course was the capital of Seoul. And when you come to the 19th century, here is where we see, you know, this kind of classic frontier and all of the kind of characteristics. So I look at the Russian Far East and Manchuria, the history unfolding in a very similar way to what happened in the American West and the Pacific Northwest. You have a frontier areas being connected to the global market, and you have these state-led projects to extract the natural resources now to be then used and sold on the market. And with that, you have the coming of people, right? So these state-led projects, the exploitation of resources creates new reasons for people to move. So similar to the boom in California, we have a kind of a boom on a lesser scale in this region of the Tumen River Valley. And this is when you have many Chinese and Koreans becoming the laborers on these, in the gold mines, railroads, etc.
Right, right. And in terms of the sort of arrival here of Russia and the kind of new presence, yeah, of both commercial and also political activity, once this sector of territory, as you mentioned there at the beginning, had been kind of hived off by the Tsarist empire, if you like, how did this alter the kind of sense that pre-existed their arrival, as you say, from the Qing side and from the Chosun side about how to rule and govern this area?
So the entrance of Russia, I would say that it made changes and also simply intensified what was already going on. So when you have the arrival of an outside power, especially one that's outside of the tributary system, right, which the Qing and the Chosun court consider as quite other, they kind of notice new things, right? So for the Russian Empire, they've come in, it's a new area, and like other areas that they've, you know, annexed, they send in explorers and geographers to do studies. And so Koreans and Chinese had already been moving around in this area. So it's not like in my book starts in 1860, you know, when the new border is drawn and more Koreans start to move. But this is not to say that Koreans were not already moving. It's just that the presence of Russia and their various explorers, it shines a spotlight on the processes that were already going on. The presence of Russia, however, does create new changes, which is that it creates new reasons to move, right? So the Qing Empire is not immediately, you know, switching from having these natural resources reserved as tribute items to then you know, exploiting them on the commercial market. This is a very gradual process for the Qing, right? And China. For Russia, they start those immediately. Railroads, extraction of, you know, coal and gold and, you know, other things in this area, not to mention land reclamation. So they immediately need workers to go about on these projects.
Right, right. And in terms of the sort of shifting experimental, I guess, sovereignty claims that different power centers started to make over the area because of this kind of transformational influence, I guess, of Russia's presence and the new markets and everything, as you say. I mean, what were the kind of new regimes that were brought in or were experimented with, if you like, kind of broadly speaking, if we're moving from a kind of broad, roughly a tributary order and one in which previously these areas had been kind of off limits and zones of exclusion. What are the sort of new traits that are brought into how sovereignty is exercised?
That's a great question. So I think that all of these states, they do see themselves as sovereign states, at least by 1600, right? So this is when political scientists and historians typically mark the beginning of, you know, the modern world, and this kind of consciousness of states about themselves as sovereign. And the definition of sovereignty that I use is an institutionalized authority claim over a delimited political space and also everything in it. And so this is a mutually exclusive institution, right? So this only exists if other people recognize that you are also sovereign, right? It goes both ways. So this idea is already in place. What changes in the period that I study is the practice of it and the capacity of states to actually carry this out. And so in my book, I look at the border region, which is in many ways an ideal place to actually look at the unfolding and the kind of the iterative projects or these experiments that I call around how sovereignty is actually made a real thing in practice for the states at the high level, but especially for the people who are living on the ground. So in my book, who are the various characters who appear in my book? You know, I was very tired of reading these high-level histories, diplomatic histories of bureaucrats who were located in the capital and not knowing what's going on the ground. And so in my book, the main characters are these no-name middle and low-level officials who were dealing with many troubles on the border. And the other characters are the people who were causing them trouble, in their own language. And these were the Koreans. So the Koreans become the kind of target of sovereignty, you know, experiments on the border. And so this is my chosen topic for the book to actually see this unfolding of sovereignty. And so what actually changes in terms of sovereignty practices as it regards to people and not territory? Well, in the mid-19th century, because of all of these kind of external changes, right, also environmental, which I guess we can get to later, you have more mobility in the region. You also have more officials paying attention. The Koreans sort of force these officials to come to terms and actually define what sovereignty means. And how does this actually take place? So for the Qing and Joseon, it's a much longer trajectory, which is never resolved, even, in 1909. But the Qing and Chosun had historically, if someone crossed the border, they were not caught and killed, they were repatriated back to their original country. So the Qing and Chosun recognize each other's claim to these people, their belonging to the political community of either state. And so they actually continue this practice in the late 19th century. And even in the early 20th century, when things change dramatically geopolitically, we see the Chosun state actually trying to continue this practice of repatriation. So the about face in Qing policy happens in the 1880s, where it reverses its policy of repatriating, and it has by then opened the Tumen Valley to, you know, de facto opened it because of migration. And they begin to claim the Koreans as Qing subjects. So this is quite unheard of. And contrary to the repeated complaints of the Chosun court, the Koreans who are living there, who have already begun to farm the land and also reclaim the land, you know, if they want to stay, the Qing officials say that they have to become Qing subjects. They have to shave their heads in the Manchu style. They need to pay taxes and register in the local household registers. On the Russian side, how are these claims made? In a very similar fashion. The Russians, you know, historically had, you know, it didn't matter what your subjecthood was or what your citizenship was. As they expanded eastward from the 15 and 1600s, they accumulated territory, but, you know, it was this vast empire. It's impossible to govern it, you know, in a standardized fashion. And so as they're accumulating land piecemeal, they have this system of plural legal jurisdiction, which essentially means that, you know, each region is sort of governed by, you know, its own set of parameters. And this was not, you know, a problematic idea for the, you know, for Russia. The Qing Empire governed probably in a similar fashion. And so from the 19th century, the mid-19th century, you have the Russian government gradually coming to terms with trying to rule its empire in a more uniform fashion. And so here, the primary divide becomes, you know, subjecthood. You know, it's important whether you're a Russian subject or, you know, if you're not a subject, you are an alien, and certain privileges are granted based on that legal status.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Right, right. And I think the interplay of these different regimes of how to construct a multi-ethnic empire of subjects with different kind of backgrounds, I mean, it really challenges, as you say, a kind of broad understanding that we maybe assume to have of sovereignty and nationhood and statehood and so on, especially in East Asia, where I think often the idea that Korean people, or there is an idea that Korean people belong in Korea and Japanese people belong in Japan and Chinese people belong in China, that those are often associated with kind of later nationalisms and sort of things that occurred, you know, after this sort of modern idea of territorial statehood emerged. But as you're saying, actually, that was already going on before, and it was only kind of as a result of changes brought about by some of these big historical cataclysms in the area that made the Qing rethink and say, well, you know, actually, at least here in particular, we need to be including Koreans as subjects. I mean, the Qing is thought of as being a kind of big multi-ethnic empire, but I guess the Northeast is usually excluded from that picture. And so that shift in this very kind of local context, I think, really is very helpful in helping us understand some of how the kind of state concepts emerged as well around this key area. But I wonder, as far as the Koreans who, I guess, accelerated a lot of these changes are concerned, or at least whose presence was a big part of these transformations. Still on the sort of introductory level, I guess, of how we talk about what was going on. You mention in the book the idea of using diaspora and related terms for these different groups. And of course, Koreans in different parts of Northeast Asia, in Japan and Russian Far East and Northeast China too, present certain challenges, I guess, to what we might understand as diaspora. So could you say how you sort of see these people as Koreans, as a diasporic population or not a diasporic population, and how you kind of conceive of them?
So certainly diaspora has very many meanings. And you might have noticed in my book, I actually don't use the word diaspora. It's, used in the beginning for, explanation. But in many ways, I was attempting in my book to kind of shatter the conventional definition of diaspora, which has this connotation of, oppression and, forced exile, and also this essentialized identity. Because of its roots, diaspora has traditionally been used in regard to the Jewish exile. So for me, I guess, I hope I don't sound too academic here, but diaspora is in spite of its being increasingly diverse in definition, for me, diaspora still retains its sort of sense of movement of a people outside a particular space of authority, usually a particular state, and also the building of a community that is both outside that space and connected to it. So I hope that didn't sound too academic. But
no, I think that's, fine.
And I actually, what was important for me in the book, and of course, diaspora was always in the back of my mind. And I guess the ways that it actually manifests itself in the book without actually using the word is the mobility, a recognition of space, consciousness of space, and how it's both sort of constructed but exploded. And also, diaspora for me has a very activist impulse. So why does this term diaspora figure so very prominently in works of Korean history and Korean anthropology? Everything's diaspora. It's because diaspora is a powerful way to reclaim a perspective that has been completely lost in the imperial archive. And so for Korea's history, it is a history of imposition, right? Of various empires trying to take over in different ways. So the imperial archive, whether it's Japanese or Russian, will speak about Koreans in a certain way, usually in Orientalist terms. And they're always assessing Koreans within the framework and within the language of empire. For example, how well or poorly do Koreans assimilate or adapt to our regime, right? So a diasporic perspective for me tries to tell a story of Koreans on their own terms. So in my case, I was butting up against imperial archives of three empires, right? And so I was actually I had to use the imperial sources, right? They're very important. And in most cases, that's all that's written. That's what we have for the documentary base. But I had to read the sources, against the grain to tell a story about this people who have in many ways, been silenced. And I think because of this activist impulse of diaspora studies, I think because of this activist impulse, diaspora remains an effective frame to do contemporary studies of Zainichi, of Joseonjok, of the Goryeo Saram, which is the name that Koreans in Russia, the former Soviet Union, give themselves.
And I think you see some of the same impulses and narratives even up to the present, right? I mean, not only in relation to Koreans per se, but lots of diasporic groups and ideas of model minority status and kind of similarly unfortunate tendencies towards, are people good at adjusting to a hegemonic sort of imperial order? It's not by any means only an artifact of this time and place. But I wonder, how did you find the archives? You mentioned, plumbing these three different sort of imperial archival resources. Obviously, that would give you some ability, I would guess, to quite literally triangulate, I suppose, and compare and work sort of in the interstices of these different sources. So could you give us a picture of the actual field work or sort of archival work that you did and where it was? I read actually a really interesting piece you wrote about the practicalities of working in the Vladivostok archives, which I think will be very helpful for anyone looking to do that. But could you say a little more about the actual kind of practical exercise of getting some of this information?
If you could just indulge me, I did want to, based on this question, also continue what I was saying about sort of the kind of the meta of the Imperial Archive, which is that it was actually because I was looking at various archives of, multiple empires that I was able to see the commonality in the language and the perspectives that these states had about the Koreans. A story, the usual story of assimilation that we see in the Russian Empire about the Koreans, or the Japanese, these assimilation debates about, Koreans with the Japanese, within the Japanese Empire. Precisely, I was able to triangulate these and see that these processes were unfolding simultaneously. And so it became, not just a history of different nations, but sort of the culmination and the making of kind of a mini international order and a language within this region. So for the practical side of research, I think anyone who's worked in the former Soviet archives knows that, there's a very steep learning curve, to say the least. But once you're in, for Russia, knowledge is power. It's very Foucauldian. So the state hoarded all the knowledge. And so once you're actually in the archives, it's immense. They kept everything. And it was very illuminating for me to go for my first time to U.S. archives this summer. And the bureaucrats had translated all of these Korean documents, but they had thrown out the original Korean post-1945. In Russia, the Tsarist government saved everything, the translations, the copies of the translations, and the original. And so for me, it really was a treasure trove of things. At the same time, the original idea was to write a microhistory of the Koreans in Pasyat, which was it was populated, it was 80% to 90%, Korean. They had their own kind of volus government there, a peasant government there. And I had seen traces of the original Korean records that they had kept. Court records, just meeting minutes, but just a few pages just to entice my interest. But unfortunately, whether these were destroyed or moved elsewhere, I could not find that level of document. Most of the book is based on, bureaucratic documents. The officials, on all three sides were immensely interested in the Koreans, but especially the Tsarist government, because unlike the Chinese, the Koreans tended to settle with their families and also stay. And so you have bureaucratic documents, you have a wealth of local newspapers, which, you know, cannot be found anywhere else in the world, but only in the State Historical Archive of the Far East, which is located in the heart of Vladivostok. And I highly recommend everyone to go. And of course, the Imperial Geographical Society, you know, published loads on the Koreans, you know, on this region. There are many, you know, we call it kraibidenye, which is, you know, just local history. You know, photos and things are found there. For the Chosun and Qing documents, I mean, those states have published, you know, compilations of bureaucratic documents over the years. So in many senses, it was quite accessible to kind of get in the head of these officials who were stationed on the ground.
And I mean, we've already moved a fair way into the concerns of the first part of the book, but I guess just staying on this theme of restoring a story about the Koreans and their movements, even if you're kind of looking for their accounts in these more official and more kind of imperially dominated sources. I wonder, could you say something more of the kind of migrant experience of these groups of Koreans moving north from the peninsula from the mid-19th century and really right up until into the first parts of the 20th century? What was it that made Koreans decide to move to China rather than Russia, if there were such underlying motivations? And how did they kind of negotiate the differences between the way that these places were governed and the way that their presence there was managed? Could you kind of say something more about this sort of perspective from below of this time of great shift and sovereignty experimentation?
Yes, absolutely. So why were they moving? Some of it was environmental factors. And I think more, you know, more scholars need to delve into this. But on a broader scale, you know, it didn't matter whether they went to Russia or China. They were simply leaving Hamgyong province, which is the northernmost province of then Joseon, Korea, because of very heavy rainfall in the 19th century. So the 19th century in this region is often known as a very wet century. So this was very harmful for the crops that they were growing in the north, which were, you know, primarily dry field crops like barley and millet. You know, in the south, of course, there was also devastating rainfall. But for Koreans in the south, if they had to move, you know, for another occupation or to find another plot of land, they simply moved to a neighboring province, you know, a neighboring town. For the people who are living in Hamgyong province, you know, moving a little meant you could actually just leave the country because it was so close. And, you know, you've been to the Tumen River, so have I. It's not a very large river. It's a very low-lying river. And in fact, the entire valley, it's very low-lying, and that's why it was prone to flooding. And often in parts, it, you know, it freezes over in the winter. There's this one funny Chosun court document that talks about the river, and it says that, you know, in the winter, the river freezes over, and not only are people running, but you can actually hear like whispers across the river. Other reasons people were going to Russia was seasonal migration. As I had mentioned, there were these, you know, large-scale projects, construction, you know, extraction projects. And so there were tens of thousands of Koreans and then many more, hundreds of thousands of Chinese who were entering and leaving the Russian Far East. So they would enter in the spring and then leave in the fall. And many people would actually, you know, build lives around the gold mines and build these towns around them and build a life for themselves. And they would have been there for, you know, years on end. Some of them, I found, you know, letters written. They were republished in Korean language newspapers in the Russian Far East. But these workers would be writing back to their families in Korea. And their families in Korea, you know, the concerned mother, of course, would just worry that her profligate son is, you know, gambling away all of his earnings, playing various, you know, games with other Koreans and Chinese in these gambling dens. So on the level of the family, though, I think the reasons for migrating were probably, you know, more complex. And at the level of the family and the individual, you do see people making choices about going to, you know, either country. And they were quite strategic in their decision making. You know, most of these people are illiterate, so they didn't, there's no, you know, documentary kind of trace that they leave about their lives. And so, again, you have to kind of read against the sources, and you can find hints in the official record. You know, there is this rare petition by a Korean farmer who's actually on the Qing side. And in the 1890s, when many of the Koreans had not naturalized, right, the Qing government officials started to force the Koreans, you know, off the land. You know, there was, you know, violence and shootings. And you see this Korean farmer, actually, you hear his voice. It's so striking. And his petition is quite long. And he complains to these Qing officials that by their actions, they're actually driving them to go to Russia, which he calls this barbarian land. You know, at the same time, I think early on in the 1860s, when this is when, you know, you have records about these devastating floods in Hamgyong province, I think rumors also spread very quickly against, this is a very kind of a tight space of a tripartite border region. And so I think rumors traveled relatively quickly. And so Koreans have heard that the Russian government has given land, food, and aid to the earlier waves of migrants. And so, again, we have this rare instance of the voice of a Korean appearing. And so he claims that reasoning, right? He cites that reasoning for taking his family to Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, that carries us across into Russia quite well, I think. I mean, if I may just move us on to kind of questions about what was going on in Russia at this time. And that, I guess, is the main focus of part two of the book. And that includes what was going on as Japan was also an increasingly kind of vigorous presence, a domineering presence over the region. So over on the Russian side of the border, which, as I say, is the kind of main focus of part two. What is kind of, you've already discussed a little bit about, you know, the importance of bringing Russia into this picture of how we look at East Asia and sort of history, the geography, and indeed the anthropology of the region. So what is it that kind of is particularly revealing, I guess, of Koreans' sort of experience in the Russian Far East, and what was it that kind of convinced you that this was something that you should really focus on for this whole second part of the book?
I would actually say that in, you know, the book started as a dissertation. The dissertation probably started in part two. And I started, again, as I had mentioned, I wanted to write a microhistory. And so that was the entry point into this entire project. I sort of work my way from the ground up to the international level. It was sort of, you know, backwards from the way the book is actually structured. And, as you know, there are many practical reasons for writing what you write about in graduate school. And the practicality was simply the difficulty of, you know, research and, you know, the very scanty existing scholarship. There have been very little written about, you know, the kind of history that I wanted to write about the Koreans in Russia. And the same was actually true for the Koreans in Kando. So I had to, you know, start with one and then try to add the other, which was the China piece, which was, you know, after graduate school. Otherwise, it would have been just too overwhelming.
Got it. And so in terms of the Korean presence there, what you did learn about the Korean presence in the Far East of Russia, the chapters of part two deal in a really fascinating way with how the kind of mobility of these populations and the evolving sovereignty regime and as you say, the kind of effort to make uniform rule over the Russian Empire, and then how that transitioned into the Soviet Union, the kind of connections that existed between Korean settlements and Korean populations, families and people doing business and seasonal migrants and so on in the Russian Far East, and their kind of compatriots, if you can call it that, back home and so on. But what kind of connections did persist between Koreans in that part of Russia as time went on? I mean, as the Tsarist government exerted a greater level of regularization and control over the area, and then as that transitions to the early Soviet period, would it be true to say that these Koreans in this area were becoming more cut off and more isolated from the peninsula that they had left?
I guess the short answer is no. I think that more people actually produced more connections. So the early settlers were were running their own villages and districts. And as a result of that, so this is the Russian side, as a result of that, they became a kind of base and a stopping point and a point of, you know, knowledge sharing for other, you know, newly arrived migrants and also, you know, people coming from Hamgyong province, the southern provinces, and also Kando. And these ties are actually, you know, strengthened with time. You have many stories about Koreans who are traveling back and forth, you know, for various reasons. Again, you know, it goes to show, you know, how we imagine this place right now as very separate, North Korea, PRC, and Russia. For many of these Koreans, I don't think they saw much of a difference in this very tightly knit tripartite border area. Of course, they made decisions about, you know, where to go based on practicalities of life. And they knew the ins and outs of the laws and, you know, how to get around. But, you know, they were tending to the graves of their ancestors in Korea. This was a Confucian rite that they took very seriously. Some of them were actually unearthing the graves of their ancestors in Korea, moving them to Russia or China. This was not an uncommon practice even within the Korean Peninsula. They're attending to business, you know, in Korea, Kando, and Russia. And what was striking to me, which became, you know, an inspiration again as I, you know, was writing the book, which was that I had met Koreans who, you know, had moved, who were from Central Asia, and they moved back to the Russian Far East, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, I would ask them about their great grandparents and how they came to Russia. And they said, they just told stories of these peripatetic lives. I was born in Hamgyong. We moved, you know, my great grandparents were born in Hamgyong. They moved to Kando. Then we moved to Russia because there was no border then. So I was constantly, you know, kind of coming up against this idea that there were borders imposed, and yet some of these people are insisting that there were no borders. But anyway, that just gives you a sense of the fluidity of this place.
Right. There's a moment in actually in Kim Il-sung's Seigi wa Tabara, with the century, where he says, I mean, it's obviously questionable how much of that at all is to be believed, but there is a point where he crosses into the Russian Far East from northeastern China or from Manchuria in 1940. So actually a great deal later in many cases than this sort of late 19th century period. Says himself, you know, he couldn't tell where that one territory ended and the next began. And as I say, I mean, whether you believe anything Kim Il-sung wrote down or the people who wrote it for him wrote down is obviously up to you. But it's a point that is made even well into the 20th century, that this was in many ways a quite borderless area in many, many places.
And actually, I'm actually thinking it is because of the imposition of a strict border regime in the actual tripartite area, the very place where the three countries meet. Because of the imposition of that and more officials stationed there, Koreans actually learned to take more circuitous routes farther north in the maritime province, perhaps even going as far north as Khabarovsk with the Heilongjiang-Khabarovsk border.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that mobility did extend all the way across an even more wide region than just this exact nexus of the three places. But I guess, I mean, as we kind of draw towards the close, and I guess some of the longer term ramifications of this kind of cross-border, or maybe cross-border doesn't even make sense if the borders themselves are quite hazy, but this presence of Koreans in multiple spaces. I wonder how and what were these groups seen as somehow threatening to the various sovereignty claims that were being exercised from Japan and from the kind of European parts of Russia or the Soviet Union? And how did those sort of interact with the projects that these places had to civilize and kind of conquer and incorporate this frontier area into their own politics?
The Koreans, you mean?
Yeah, how was their presence seen as being a potential threat, yes, to that?
I mean, it's sort of ironic to think, you know, Koreans are from a relatively weak state, and yet we see this persistent language in the sources about how they were a problem. At many times, you know, at least in the Russian case, that they were a danger. On the Chinese side, right, after the colonization of Japan, Japan's colonization of Korea in 1910, the Koreans also become this kind of danger. And the Japanese refer to Koreans abroad as a danger. So why is this, if Korea itself is seen as a comparatively weak state? It's actually precisely because of all of these, you know, imperial machinations upon Korea that are projected onto Korea, I think, that Korean migrants come to be seen as this problem and in many times a threat, because they could embody the power of these various empires. These empires were imagined to be using the migrants who were malleable, right, and weak themselves to spread their influence across borders. So we see the Tsarist officials are worried about the Qing doing that, migrants in Russia, Korean migrants in Russia. After 1910, Russians believe that Japanese are using the migrants to spread their influence, right? In Russia and also Kando. And then, you know, the Japanese themselves, they're worried about the subversive activities of these Korean migrants seeping back into Korea, right? Their actual colony. So Koreans as weak and malleable and, you know, embodying the threat of imperial powers. So this all, they kind of become a proxy for the intense geopolitical anxieties that are emerging at the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's really, fascinating kind of way of understanding that, and a very compelling one, where you're looking at states that are becoming perhaps increasingly intolerant of any sense of overlap or blurring in terms of the areas they consider themselves to control and their proximity to rivals, and their anxieties are then sort of mapped on to a mobile population who, you know, then seem to sort of embody the kind of insecurity, I guess, that, as you say, comes from inter-imperial competition and so on. And so then in the sort of epilogue of the book, you touch on, I guess, what might be seen as a sort of final, you know, or at least in the period you're concerned with here, a final violent outgrowth of what we've been talking about so far, and that is the 1937 deportation, which you mentioned all the way actually at the beginning of this conversation. So how early, in your view, were the seeds of this sown? I mean, do you think we can understand the 1937 deportation of Koreans from the Russian Far East to Central Asia? Is it helpful to see it in the context of what was going on, say, late in the 19th century?
If we just remove the word deportation and rename it, you know, forced resettlement, I think we can actually see the 1937 tragedy or incident as really consistent with Tsarist government policy from the very moment that Koreans began to migrate to the Russian Far East. The Tsarist government consistently spoke of trying to move the Koreans away from the border region and to move them farther north, where they would be able to mix with other Slav settlers and thereby, you know, lose their native backward ways. So in that sense, it's sort of a continuous policy. And, you know, this resettlement programs are not unusual for large empires. You know, the Qing does this in Manchuria. It's moving, you know, these bannermen from Beijing to various areas in Manchuria because of the lack of people. And certainly the Tsarist government did this throughout its history. Of course, we cannot forget the heightened, you know, geopolitical tensions and, of course, domestic tensions, ideological tensions within the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And so this is what causes the frenzy, you know, around the Koreans in the Russian Far East. You know, Japan has declared the Soviet Union, you know, its enemy in the 1930s. You have, you know, after collectivization, you know, the population is devastated. People are still reeling from that. You know, tensions on the Western Front. And of course, these are again sort of imputed. These anxieties are imputed on the Korean people in the Russian Far East. So they're named ideological enemies and also kind of international enemies, labeled Japanese spies. And of course, they become the first ethnic forced deportation during the Great Terror.
Right, which then, I guess, also comes to include various other ethnic groups and people spanning the entire space of the massive Soviet empire. So in a sense, I guess at this very granular, nuanced case gives us a great sort of volume of insight into much broader processes occurring right across the Soviet Union and indeed, I think, across time in different places today. I mean, you've mentioned North Korea a couple of times and the kind of anxieties and the kind of problematization of inhabitants of that country moving around persists right up until the present. So it's hardly a thing that we can banish to the history books or to the, you know, obscure archives in Vladivostok or anywhere else. So, Alisa, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to us today about all of this. I mean, there's a whole lot we didn't get to, and I would vigorously encourage listeners to pick up a copy of the book and really delve into some of the other great trove of information and rich stories and kind of really revealing analysis, I would also say, of what's going on in the interstate relationships too, that is all in the book. Before we let you go, finally, perhaps I'll ask you what you're up to now. You've mentioned that you're moving into some US archives. Is that in relation to a current project you have on the go, or what's come since the book?
Yes. First, a very good break for myself. And my first book was about people who left Korea. And so my second project will be about people who returned to Korea. So this is people who repatriated after 1945, the collapse of the Japanese Empire, and then, you know, the birth of arguably a new empire on the Korean Peninsula, which was the U.S. So this story of repatriation, I guess, is sort of an exploration into the fact that Korea never had a post-war period, a post-colonial period. In fact, we never hear the word decolonization in regard to Korea. Certainly, we hear that for the Japanese Empire, right? It was de-imperialized, demembered as an empire. But why? When Korea was a colony, of course, did it not have this process? And of course, it's because of division, reoccupation by the Soviet Union and the US, you know, extreme violence, and then you have another war. And so I'm looking at these traumatic events post-1945, again, through the lens of mobility, the Koreans who are trying to make their way back to their homeland. So we will see how that progresses.
Well, if it's anything like this project, I'm sure it will be absolutely fantastic. And yeah, greatly look forward to reading what comes out of that analysis of, as you say, people moving in the other direction. But in the meantime, Elisa, thank you so much for appearing again. It was wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and we will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.